This is The Crucible. The JRTC Experience. This is where we discuss warfighting skills and lessons learned in a decisive action training environment for large-scale combat operations at JRTC.
Hi, I'm Colonel Matt Hardman, the Commander of Operations Group here at the Joint Readiness Training Center. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Crucible, the JRTC Experience. And today, we're fortunate to be joined by one of my former comrades and good friends, Dr. Rob Simmons. Rob, could you tell us about yourself?
Hey, I'm Rob Simmons. I'm visiting here from the United States Military Academy at West Point.
All right, tell us about you.
So, let's see. I'm a 98 graduate of West Point. I went to the 82nd for my first duty assignment.
I should feel like I should be at the position of attention when we say that.
Just because of the 82nd?
Yeah.
Fair.
Back with the division.
Right, right. Spent all of my time in 2 Panther, where I met Colonel Hardman, Matt, and we deployed to Afghanistan together. After that, things didn't work out with the Army, so I got out but stayed in the defense complex. And worked for several projects in for ARI and Asymmetric Warfare Group, and then
ARI Army Research
Army
Institute.
Research Institute. Yeah. Yeah. So we did a project like how do we make platoon leaders adaptable? Well, it turns out the answer is not like, hey, show up at 9 a.m. and be adaptable.
Yeah,
like that it doesn't work. It's like you gotta decide when and where. While doing that type of work, I met my advisor and then went to Stanford and got a PhD in how people learn from and with technology. And
so you studied how people learn to use technology and with technology.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. Right. Yeah. So if technology is a combat multiplier, we noticed in our time, or at least in my time in the Army, that some soldiers gravitated towards adopting technology and other soldiers were like,
ran away from it.
Get that the heck away from me.
Yeah.
And so I was like, that's an interesting phenomenon. You know, like why? I personally think that understanding how people use technology is the metal task of the military that will sustain no matter what warfare looks like. It's like adopting the new stuff and then figuring out how to use it. So that's kind of driven my career. And so drove my grad school time. Then I was a professor at Naval Postgraduate School, and now I'm a research fellow at West Point.
Okay, and how long have you been up at West Point?
Just about a year.
Okay, so. And we randomly ran into each other, I think, about a year ago back up there?
Yeah, no. So we knew that the S&T community was not understand science and technology community, the developers of the technology for the warfighter, were not getting, they didn't get ground truth. Like it's I've made a lot of money, not a lot of money.
Not real money.
Yeah, not real
metaphorical money.
Yeah, right, exactly. Telling people how the Army works and like what the Army does, because they don't get into your shorts much.
Yeah.
You know, they're like sitting in a lab in middle of nowhere thinking like, oh, I think this might be a problem the Army has. And it's like, you know, you need to come see it.
So, all right. So why did you, and who did you come down here with and why did you come down here?
Right. So I came down here with a group out of DEVCOM, the Army Research Lab, and this group works specifically on ground autonomy and multi-robots working together. Dr. Ethan Stump, you should look up his work. He's a great guy and very knowledgeable. And then Dr. Carlos Nieto is another colleague that came with me. Both of those guys do great stuff. And they're very interested in the warfighter perspective, which I found to be unusual. So I said, I'm gonna exercise every connection I got, which happened to be you, to get them to like see what a warfighter does and see the challenges they have. And so now they're going back and they're thinking, oh, this is what it's like to fight at night. This is what it's like to do a log pack. This is how long it takes to do an air assault. So now they have like meat on the bones of what the warfighter needs.
They gotta walk the floor of the friction factory here.
Yeah, we did.
So you know, what were the big takeaways from the team? I mean, we sat down and talked to them, but from your perspective, what were the big things you think they took away from getting to be immersed here? Spent 6 days in the box, a total of 3 nights in the box.
Yeah. For people that didn't sign up to wear the uniform, these guys were troopers. We were out 3 full nights did a train. Four things, I think, but we saw a lot and we talked to a lot of folks, and that was super awesome. The first is that time scales matter, right? So a lot of people think about Skynet and shooting robots and stuff like that, like pew, pew, pew.
Skynet.
And, you know, it's coming, you know, right? And what turns out, like, okay, there are ethical issues that are legit. There are timing issues, like when to lift and shift fires. And so you need to identify both friend and foe with high precision to lift and shift fires. So there are a lot of technological issues there, and it's got to happen fast, right? You know, it has to happen as fast as guys can run. That's hard. Easier things would be like, hey, can you bring me some more water, please?
Yeah.
You know, can you take away my casualties? A robot can leave from a given point, come to me, navigate that terrain. On their own, this is what Ethan and Carlos are working on, and then follow its path back. You know, that's low-hanging fruit. Can you tether up a blimp that has a radio on it that helps our mesh network, you know, from one terrain feature back, you know, beyond the flood? That's doable. Another thing would be that you brought up that I think is possible is like, getting involved with a breach, you know, either obscuration or the actual breach acid.
Yeah,
the reduction. So I think that's a step up, but the time scales on both of those are much slower than, you know, fire and maneuver, you know. So I think that's one of our big takeaways. The other ones are kind of like, they're a little less sexy, but they kind of range the dot mil PF is like, how are we going to man these things? Who's going to be in charge of like training these guys? How much training do they need? Do you need a PhD in robotics? Yeah, that's probably not going to work for the Army.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, like maybe once, you know, like maybe somebody to set the POI or the program of instruction. But, you know, like we need soldiers to be able to train soldiers in robotics. And so what does that look like? You know, what do we manufacture versus what do we train? You know, those types of things. They're coming to the front with the Raven, and then, the supply chain as well. How do we get parts?
How do we sustain it?
Yeah. Right. And how do we power it?
So how, you know, the experience here in the rotation, and you spent a lot of time, you got to see both the rotational unit as well as Geronimo, the opposition force.
Yep.
Those kind of 4 issues that you highlighted, what were some of the ahas from your counterparts?
Oh, man. They were all over the place. I think we walked out of every meeting with kind of an aha. So I think One aha was like how deliberate the insertion might be for an aerosol. Yeah. So if you're going to have an unmanned aerial system up for an aerosol, either you know providing early warning or calling for seed, or you need hours, or you need hours of that type
coverage.
of coverage, not 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, it works for 20 minutes. Then you just recharge it for 4 hours. Well, it's not gonna meet the operation.
It's not gonna be relevant.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So seeing how deliberate aerosols have to be, it was one. Operating at night, the tunnel vision, the night vision goggles create troubleshooting a robot at night. We talked about that when we were, in the dead space. You can't just whip out a computer.
Right.
So we need computer screens that are
NVG friendly.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That have no backlight, like a tablet, a Kindle, where you can just dial in your NVG to see it, to troubleshoot if you need to troubleshoot. Just how slow we move in the dark.
Yeah.
You know,
it must have been fun though, having you had experience. You and I were in Afghanistan, did mm-hmm. a bunch of time in the 82nd. It must have been interesting, though, to have two PhDs that have no background in this, really smart guys, exposed to seeing the friction that we have here.
So, one of the things personally that I took out of the trip was like, you don't remember what it's like not to know.
Right.
You know, so like walking, I got my nods. I haven't used nods in 10 years. Strapped them onto my face, got them right on this bump in my nose where I like them, and I was dialed in, and I was like ready to go. I'm like, you guys ready? Let's walk. And they're like, and I was like, what's wrong, guys? And like, just their whole helmet setup was not quite right, and I was like, "Oh, I failed these guys because I forgot the basics."
You and every team leader that comes here, right?
Yeah, right. I was like the worst team leader of this rotation. the worst team leader award goes to Rob Simmons. And one of them was using the IR illuminator constantly, and I was like, "Stop that! That is not good." And
he's like, making the Geronimo squad leader unhappy.
We went out one night just to watch the aerosol by ourselves and stayed away from everybody so we could do some of this stuff. Because the squad leader would have lost his mind. And I was like, what? No, what are you doing? Well, it turns out he had the dimmer down.
Okay.
And so, I was like, oh, I forgot about the dimmer. I gave a horrible block of instruction to these guys.
But that's like its own value for them of okay, as we provide systems to soldiers, things have to be very intuitive, right?
Well, that's right. Or you need to understand the conditions under which they need to operate these systems.
And that people are operating multiple systems. And I say intuitive, that our soldiers aren't smart, but we're asking them to be highly proficient on a weapon, highly proficient on optics, highly proficient on a set of NVGs, on a radio. And now we're asking them to do it, adding a small UAS and potentially, ground capabilities.
Right.
So we're asking our soldiers to do a lot with technology. And the easier we make those tasks for them, the more of those tasks they're going to be able to do well.
That's right. That's right. And especially, I got to talk to A Company First Sergeant last night, who's one of the augmentee Op 4.
Oh, yeah.
First Sergeant Flynn, great guy, and. He was just sharing his perspective. We want to get these guys trained, and but you're pushing a boulder up a hill. Syphilis understands. And so any way we can make that hill, S&T can make that hill a little more shallow, you know, that's a win.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
You know, so, to be coherent in the fastest way to train people, I don't know, and I have a PhD in how people learn, right? I don't know that I can do a better job than experience sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes I can tell you about it,
yeah,
and then you're like, oh, that's a good story. I'm going to remember that one.
Well,
and
I mean, it's in our name, you know, yeah, the JRTC experience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's by, you know, this place is a teacher.
Yeah, right, right.
For sure,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you stories from my JRTC rotation.
Well, so how many rotations do you have here?
I have one I was a PL in Bravo 2 Panther.
Bravo 2505.
Yep. And then I was back here as an augmentee for a K-4 rotation because my first job right after Ranger School was going to K-4 and being a nug in the 3-shot while I waited for a platoon.
Okay, and so what'd you learn from your rotation as a platoon leader here? What are your memories of that experience?
Number one, the value of the OC. I can see his face, I cannot remember his name, but I had a very thoughtful OC that coached me very well along the way. I learned more from that guy than I learned anywhere else. So, we jumped on Geronimo, and we were screwed up in assembly, right? The Steiner aids
never happens, right?
No, yeah, nobody ever dies on Geronimo DZ, right? Like that's just free chicken. Said nobody ever. So we got the Steiner aids up, and it's been about an hour. So clearly the cog is like holding Geronimo back and those guys are licking their chops. And then finally they get to call for the D-30s or whatever and our Steiner aid gets hit. And I'm like, we gotta get off this Steiner aid. And for what, you know, friction. I'm not saying anybody was screwed up, but we hadn't rehearsed well getting off the Steiner aid. So my first death at JRTC was at the Steiner aid on Geronimo DZ. Well, I open up my casualty card and it says return to duty. And that's because my OC wanted me to get a chance to lead and do the job. And that part of being an OC is essential to this place, yeah. I think so. We went into the defense and, you know, Geronimo pivot steered on our foxholes.
Yeah.
We tried our best. I did do something creative that I thought my OC recognized that was, I only had 2.5 squads. Well, I had 2.5, I had my weapons team or weapons squad and then 2.5 squads. And so I took my half squad and the junior squad leader, well, he was a team leader, and so I promoted him to squad leader and made him an anti-tank squad. And I was like, we need 2 AT-4s to kill anything. You take them both, and then you go kill it. Like, just go, you know, beat Geronimo, you know, like, you know, and he tried. He tried hard. We still got pivot steered on.
And then you were back here as a guest OCT, and what was that rotation like?
It was interesting being on the other side, right? Like it was 10th Mountain that was here. I think it was 1st Brigade 10th Mountain that was here. They were getting ready to go to Kosovo. So at the time, you know, JRTC is like hemming and hawing about how do we go into peacekeeping ops and what do those things look like. And so I got to see some of the machinations of like how the whole industry of creating a good rotation for a unit. And then right in the middle of it, 9/11 happened. And, you know, the New York Battalion, a lot of New York ties. Brought sat phones into the box, tried to check in on families, and then the leadership said, hey guys, we're in the best training environment ever. Let's get to work. And holy crap, did they go after Geronimo.
And you know what's, I mean, that unit, 110, then ended up going and was the first conventional unit that deployed forward to Afghanistan. And that's, you know, that experience here is always in the back of my mind. Every unit that we touch, they're the most ready unit when they step out of here.
I believe it.
And that's, you know, happened across all the CTCs multiple times, that, you know, a unit comes and trains and within months is going to do something, you know, real world for the nation. You know, that, you know, your experience in the military and then, you know, shifting that into, you know, what you've been doing really for the last decade, you know, where do you think we're going from a science and technology, and what are, you know, what are the opportunities, and then what are maybe some of the challenges that we have in front of us as we try to deliver for warfighters the capabilities to win and to be more lethal and more survivable on the battlefield?
Whew. Do you have any easier questions that you could ask? So you don't get into S&T if you're not an optimist. You know, like, you have to believe that I'm going to make a thing that is going to be better than not making a thing. And so I think that I hope that the Army S&T community is paying attention. You know, for many of our technologies, it doesn't matter if we're in COIN or LSCO. We need them. You know, carrying stuff sucks. That's physics.
Right.
You know, like it sucks.
Heavy things are heavy.
Yeah, right.
100 pounds of lightweight gear is still 100 pounds of gear.
Yes.
Right.
Right. So some of those things, okay, got it. You know, and it doesn't matter. But the expert move is time. Like, how fast are you going to get it to me? You know, if it's faster for my Joes to hump it than it is for you to bring it to me, and it gives me more flexibility as a leader, well, I mean, have you actually solved a problem or not? You know, so I hope we're getting better at understanding the constraints and the situations of the problem, which is why I want to keep bringing S&T people down here to run around in the woods until 6 a.m. But I also think that the tools we have that enable innovation are getting easier to use, which is kind of a double-edged sword. You know, you can Google a lot of stuff and like come up with some kind of hacky program that does something for you that automates your life. That works both for us and against us.
Right.
You know, so I don't know. That's a really crappy answer. Bad answer.
Yeah, I mean, but this is like, you know, I'm talking about this with folks. I mean, the reality of the modern battlefield is the proliferation of technology, you know, from an accessibility standpoint. It's cheaper. It's easier to produce. There's the access, I mean, in terms of a lot of these things, you know, the barriers to entry. When we think about night observation equipment, when we think about AI or machine learning applications, all of those are more accessible and cheaper than they ever were before.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, it's like a form of contact.
Right.
You know, barriers to entry go both ways.
Right.
They work both for the Blue 4 and the Op 4.
And then, you know, from a lethality perspective, you know, these things are getting better. You know, probability of kill keeps going up, you know, to infinitesimal error rate for ATGMs, you know, for some of these systems, just because of the quality of things out there. We can put a more potent warhead on an ATGM than we could 20 years ago, based on improvements. And so that, you know, that transparent battlefield that we can see further, we can reach further, and oh, by the way, if we can see it, we can hit it, and if we can hit it, it's probably dead.
Yeah.
You know, is you know, I don't think it's revolutionary. I think it's all evolutionary. But it definitely makes the battlefield a dangerous place to be right now.
Yes, 100% agree. I think the name of the game is time. You know, when we can put up a drone right now, I can put out a sensor right now that will give an 8-digit grid to whatever it's looking at from, you know, half a click away. How I get that into a fire mission that's approved and deconflicted in a second.
Right.
You know, we're not there. We're nowhere near that. But I think it's coming.
Yeah. No, and yeah, how we tie these things together, how things communicate. You know, and it's like when I get the chance to talk to science and technology people, you know, so one, I'm advocating for you light fighters out there. It's got to be lightweight, right? I mean, the weight issues, power generation issues, the sustainment, we can't transfer that burden onto
the soldier's back. No,
right?
No. Or it has to be self-sufficient.
Right.
You know, like that would be I don't think we're going to get around the physics of that anytime soon for the light fighter. Sorry, guys. But at the same time, we're idiots in the S&T community if we think we're going to put it on your back. You know, we will either need to drop it off to you and then either blow it in place, or which is expensive, or have a way to self-recover.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's just a non-solution. Like right now, our robots, they need a lot of batteries. They need a lot of heavy batteries. Way more than what it takes to run your Syngar's radio, your Prick 119 from the old days.
Yeah, but it can't be this transference to the back of a soldier.
No.
Right.
No.
And this.
I want to say that I'm a light fighter, but the minute I start talking robotics, I'm like, where do I put my cooler? Because not just for me, not just for my creature comforts. Sometimes you need to cool the batteries.
Batteries.
You know, like you're in this power fight all the time.
Yeah.
You know, like, and where do I put my generator?
Right.
Who's bringing me gas? I'm suddenly a frickin' Delta company at least, maybe more.
And when we talk sustainment, power generation, power transfer is part of how we really, in this era, have to talk about sustainment. That's got to be part of the conversation.
We're useless without it.
Right.
You know, we're one shot without it.
The other is, you know, it's the Call of Duty or the Halo rule. Like, nobody that's played those games, like, read the manual or played the tutorial. They picked it up, and they were intuitively able to play the game.
I did the tutorial.
You did? Well, no. you got a PhD. but for the rest of
I'm a slow learner.
You know,
No, I got
you. And we talked about this earlier, like this idea, we got to get away from something that requires the 80-hour course that we're expecting the 11 Bravo 10 to operate a thing, because we don't have time. We're already task saturated, right? And so, you know, the UAS that a soldier is able to pick up, you know, use the controller that's common controller, and intuitively figure out how to do it after kind of one or two reps of doing it, back to the experience learning. That's where we really, the space we gotta be in. We gotta make this all much easier for the user.
Let me break apart easier. Agree with you.
Yeah, well, you got the PhD in this.
So, I was having this discussion with First Sergeant last night. So ATAC can be overwhelming, you know, if I just tossed it at you and said, hey, go to ATAC and start doing stuff. But you log in to ATAC, right? So it knows who you are. And so it should also know the last time you used ATAC. So let's say that you got super proficient, you're downrange, you learned every capability there was, because you're bored out of your frickin' skull watching sand dry. And then, you know, you're squad leader, and then you go to recruiting for 3 years, and then you come back and you're back in an operational unit. Why doesn't ATAC say, hey, Sergeant, good to see you back. What do you need to do? Let me set up a tutorial just in time to refresh you again. Yeah. You know, like, why is it the case that our training isn't individualized on some of these systems? Like, oh, I remember how to, you know, load a radio. I don't remember how to, I don't know, clear a radio or you know, something like that. You know, like, hey, I need this. You know, walk me through this. You know, so that, I think that would be like acknowledging where soldiers are at in their learning and forgetting. You know, like we all forget, you know, it's perishable skills. We all know. And creating systems not just that have a capability, but help meet us where we're at would make it easier.
Yeah.
So you're getting tailored just-in-time training rather than this 80-hour, of course, like, hey, welcome. So my classic example of this was I was a plebe at West Point, and I finish Calc 2, right? Done with Calculus 2. I got like a C+ or something. Calculus is not my thing. And I went home for 2 weeks for block leave, and then came back to start summer training, which was provided by an operational unit. Now, the NCOs did not know cadets really, but we started the land nav training, and the NCO was like, all right, cadets, there are 360 degrees in a circle. I'm like, bro, I just took a Calc 2 final 2 weeks ago. Like, you're not meeting me where I'm at, you know, and we need to do that.
Yeah.
We need to do that.
And yeah, so, have you ever met or worked with Chris Colbert, who worked at the Harvard's Innovation Lab?
I have not.
So, yeah, he gave a great talk called Technology is Dead. And his whole thing is like, you know, we got to start with technology focused on the user. And to this point, we got to meet the user where the user's at. And the sooner we do that, the more we're going to be able to harness it, and then we're going to have less frustration, right? And I think your team coming down here, you got immersed with the users, in a sense of seeing the things that squad leaders, platoon sergeants, platoon leaders, company commanders really are struggling with, and what their real requirements are. I mean, it's great. We got Army requirements, and not that those are bad requirements, but they're much more informed when we understand, you know, what the users out there are struggling with and need. And so it's pretty cool that you guys were able to do that. Hey, but I want to kind of riff off something you said earlier that I think ties to that is, you know, your view that, you know, it's probably a bell curve, right, of people, of those that are early embracers of technology, the Luddites that want nothing to do with the technology, and those of us sort of like kind of in the middle of the curve. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what you've observed with that?
So I saw this a lot at Stanford, and like the Silicon Valley has like they kind of market segment a new technology often, where you have like kind of early adopters and then kind of mid-cycle users and then eventual adopters, and they
and then the people that don't have phones or email.
Sorry, Nana. I don't think, and I'm probably speaking outside of my lane a little too much, but I don't think that the UI UX community has done enough to push people into an early adoption mindset. So, for example, you buy a new phone, and you know, you're like, email. Why do I need email on my phone? You know, like circa 1999.
Yeah, right? Yeah, right.
And then you're like, oh, actually,
that'll never catch on. Yeah.
And then you're like, well, hey, wouldn't you like to just be able to, like the BlackBerry, wouldn't you be able to like to reply to this and not have to do 45 emails at once throughout your day? Well, that was the use case. You know, it's like,
and then the counter is that now you're doing email all day.
I just don't do email. Yeah. I'm like, don't email me. I'm not available. No. But so like figuring out how to get people into the adoption curve, you know, show me a squad leader that says, you give him a piece of technology and you said, this will save your squad's life. And he'll say, hey, sir, go pound sand. You know, I'll show you a guy that needs to get out of the army.
Yeah.
Right? That's not how squad leaders think. It is the problem that they have is like, sir, you're putting another rock in my rucksack.
Maybe literally.
Yeah, if it sucks. Yeah. You know, what do you want me to give up? You know, help me make trades, you know, about why I need to learn this new technology and not keep using what has worked for me thus far.
Right.
And
it's about value.
There's this bias towards what we know works, right?
Yeah.
So G6 talked about this. So Geronimo, all you Blue 4 rotations coming up, Geronimo has mesh networks now. They have Silvus radios. It's a great frickin' radio. We use them up at West Point for our robots and working human-robot interaction. It's painful to pick up the first time. It's basically an IT network, so now instead of thinking frequencies, you're thinking IP addresses. But he had done this before, and he says, folks, it's gonna be painful. We're gonna do it. I'm forcing it. He put the command emphasis on that. Everyone nodded. Everyone was like, all right, sir. You know, like, but he said, this is it. I'm willing to accept that our networks might be degraded for a minute while we learn.
To get to a higher level.
To get to a much higher level and much more reliable.
So it's funny you say that. I mean, we have this struggle here oftentimes with digital fires, right? Because I can do voice in a company live fire. I can do voice on a company live fire, and voice works perfectly,
mm-hmm.
and it's efficient, and mm-hmm. it's effective.
But it doesn't. Because they're right there.
Because it's right there. But it doesn't scale.
Right.
Right? And it certainly doesn't scale to the brigade level of, I have one battalion, generally either organic or DS to the brigade, depending on the division right now. And I have to be able to rapidly mass fires, timely and accurate fires, and do it multiple times. And the only way you can do that is through digital fires.
Right, right.
And so people will nod and say, oh yeah, I see the value in that. But until they've seen it, and we get this here, when they see it, it's eye-popping. Because it's like, wait a minute. Like, we were able to shoot 400 rounds, and our effectiveness, you know, has gone up to 75% to where all our fires are timely, they're accurate, and if we can merge the intel collection with the fires, like every time we shoot a fire mission, we're killing the enemy.
Yeah.
Versus voice, we're usually shooting behind the duck,
yeah.
or behind, we're mm-hmm. not accurate because of errors and time. And so that's, you know, with the technology, it's demonstrating the value, but I think oftentimes you only get there by what you describe with Geronimo 6, and no, like, I got it. This is hard and it's uncomfortable, and it may be inconvenient at your echelon.
Right.
But at scale, this is gonna make us incredibly effective.
Yeah.
You know, some of this right now is, you know, with, you know, UAS, I mean, barriers to employ in UAS as well.
Absolutely. So I was out at NTC some number of rotations ago, and I don't remember the unit, so I'm not throwing anybody under the bus intentionally.
Yeah, we don't do that. No shade on units.
But the Raven was an afterthought.
Yeah.
And there was a disconnect between the Knight S2, you know, the fight was coming the next morning, so All the adult supervision had gone to bed, and the Knight S2 is trying to relay the NAIs to the Raven unit, whoever it was, and like why they stepped out of the talk without having the NAIs to look at. And then I just hear this thing doing laps up there.
Yeah.
And it was alone and unafraid, and it just wasn't the emphasis.
It wasn't being driven.
Might be completely appropriate for where that unit was at.
Yeah.
Like, you know, log pack, fuel, yeah. Getting bullets. Maybe all of that stuff was way more important at the time. But you're not going to see results if you don't have command emphasis on
yeah.
it, on technology.
Well, and you spent some time with the squadron that we had here.
Yeah.
This rotation.
Yeah, yeah. And those guys are after it.
Yeah, and being driven by the squadron commander.
That's right.
You know, who wasn't asking if they wanted to employ Ravens. They were tasking them at an NAI at a time to answer PIR for the squadron.
Yep.
Mixed with the SIGINT and EW. And tied to digital fires.
Yeah.
They trained that way.
And we saw some pretty good Raven flying, too.
Yeah.
So you can fly a Raven along, and it just has a signature, right? Like the little motor has a signature. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So some dude in the box right now, dude or dudette, is firing this thing up to the top of the AGL, and then gliding it around. And I'm like,
ingenious.
I'm looking at it through nods, and I'm like, what the heck is that? And then here's the only thing they didn't do right. They haven't done the calculation to get, this is the only way I knew what the heck they were doing. They didn't do the calculation to get out of earshot.
Before turning the engine
before
back
up. Getting back up.
Yeah.
To the top of their AGL, but they were looking at
that. Isn't that the coolest thing in the world?
I know. I'm gonna find
that soldier.
Yeah, give that person a coin.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Because I don't know.
That's how we're gonna win.
That
you
well,
know
that's
that
right.
kind of thinking.
Yes.
Right.
Like, and so they were right over G-Man here's the other thing that's happening is like. Both G-Man and Blue Four are getting immune to stuff buzzing around overhead. I mean, heck, you know, the InfoWars guys, if a drone flies over you, you're gonna get hit.
Yeah.
Get out. Displace.
Yeah. Displace.
Yeah. Like go just because. Well, and I'll tell you, they're only gonna get better at this. You know, right now they fly a loop on you. They figure out where you are through a number of different methods, and then they have a conversation over the radio.
Well, I mean, I'll just clear the like they're using electronic warfare collection
yes.
in those drones. They're using full motion video day and night in
yes.
those drones.
And thermal.
And thermal.
Yes.
Right.
So they got all three.
Right.
But the one.
So we're not hiding anything from anybody.
Oh, well, if do people watch this?
Yeah, are you
getting ready to come down here?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh yeah, turn off your Bluetooth, team. Turn off your Bluetooth. Yeah, no, like Phoenix Watch, call for fire.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah, especially out in the swamp.
Oh.
Right in the middle of nowhere. It's one thing if you're with 10,000 people in a town and it's
right.
a needle among a needle.
Right.
It's another thing if you're out in the middle of nowhere
That's
and you've
right.
got your Garmin going or
right.
your watch going.
If you're an MPRC
yeah.
alpha
yeah.
and you got a really high-speed modem, they know it. And they know, oh, that's a brigade talk.
Yeah.
So.
And these are unclassed systems.
These are it's
off the shelf.
Not off the shelf and openware.
Yeah.
Like, this is not, they're not doing any sort of spooky stuff. This is like,
yeah.
and the guys that are doing it.
Which, to my earlier conversation about the proliferation, that means our adversaries are
100%.
Doing it, can do it,
100%.
Will do it.
Yeah,
right?
yeah, 100%. Yeah. I think it's happening daily in Ukraine.
Yeah.
So anyway, but right now they flew one round and then they're like, oh, we found some stuff. This looks interesting. Let's hit it. And then they had to fly another sortie. I think they're going to get that time cycle shortened such that One flies it, the other comes right up over the top, and you got 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then,
and that's if they're not dropping munitions from the UAS.
Oh no, I think that the second yeah. sortie is dropping.
Yeah. Yeah. So, or calling for fire, or both.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's impressive. So the, like, I don't know. I don't know where we're going. We're just having fun. But I think that we gotta keep trying different stuff out, and we gotta keep, like, commanders need to push innovation, push technology adoption, reward soldiers for the struggle.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's really important in terms of, like, you know, I had so many soldiers that worked for me in my short time where, and I mean, some of them were in BCO when you took it over. You look at this guy, and he's a freaking genius. Like, he's just...
Crazy Pete.
Yeah, right. And
I mean, that guy was amazing.
Hated school.
Yeah.
Absolutely hated school. Would learn everything about anything to make the unit better.
Yeah, absolutely.
And why was that? Because, you know, he's like, oh, sir, I don't know about this. I'm not good at school. I'm like, I think you can do it. Yeah. A little bit of belief in them, and then room to fail, and, you know, say, you're going to help the unit if you do this. Those three things together will drive technology adoption.
And I'm going to cut you off. After the Army, he's a technology developer.
There you go.
I've been in touch with him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Right.
Great soldier.
Right.
No, I agree. You know, we got to nurture those folks and give them opportunities to grow. And so you got to spend time with our InfoWars cell here.
Oh, we're tied in.
And they're small in numbers, but kind of what were your takeaways with, you know, what they're doing that's going to make life hard for rotational units?
So what InfoWars is doing is paying attention to all of your signatures. And if they can do it with three people in the shop, and then a team that is three teams that are out putting out sensors, so 12 people total, anybody can do it with 12 people total. So watch, lock down that EW stuff.
Yeah, and you know, if you're out there and you're in a unit, you want to come here as an EW folks and come fight with Geronimo, you're always welcome. Reach out to operations group, and if your unit approves, we'll help facilitate you come fight with EW InfoWars cell so your team can learn.
I also think that we need them learning with Blue 4 also.
Absolutely.
Like have the, so I don't think there's, you know, there's so many things on a commander's plate, right? Especially when the brigade commander is trying to do all of the things, like all of the warfighting functions. You know, you can't see EW.
Yeah.
I can see a Humvee without fuel.
Yeah.
You know, I can't see what I look like.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and we're trying to do that from the 21st Airborne.
That would be great.
From the division help units see themselves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, no, it's good stuff. Okay, hey, what questions do you have of me? We spent a bunch of time together. What do you want to ask me or tell me?
No, I mean, first thing is, like, I think what I want to tell you is that this is you got a great sandbox to make better warriors here. You know, from top to bottom, you know, this remains a world-class training facility from what I can tell. I guess my question to you is, what's next? How are you going to do better?
Yeah. So, you know, we've got an eye, obviously, you know, as the Army modernizes to the Army of 2030, you know, that's like the mark out there that we've aim point for us, looking at the capabilities that the Army's, you know, looking to field and modernization, as well as the doctrinal changes that we're making. And that's kind of the aim point that we've set for ourselves over the last year, and my predecessors as well. And then we'll probably reassess that as the Army makes adjustments with modernization. But, you know, as we look at long range vertical lift capabilities, what are going to be the requirements to train that here? This idea of the transparent battlefield, you know, continuing to evolve the operational environment to be one more realistic, more challenging, but also to give that, you know, the context that we're going to fight in, particularly from an electromagnetic signature standpoint. Mm-hmm. Talk to you about terraforming the box. And so as we, you know, over the years ahead, and we have a plan to make some of our landing zones bigger to facilitate more aircraft. You know, we took pictures from Europe and the Pacific, and we're looking to model some of the box to look that way in terms of, you know, how we're clearing, how we're moving some of our buildings around to make the environment more realistic to what we think folks will fight through. You know, with Geronimo, they're going to field a motorized capability here in the next year. They're fielding more ADA assets as well as radars. And then the other part is in the virtual space. So we're the integrated system that we have, you know, we can replicate things in the electromagnetic signature in the virtual space that still can be sensed and felt by a unit in the dirt.
Oh yeah, that's great.
That lets us get at a scale that often is hard to do if you're just doing it live.
Yeah.
But based on the geolocation within the instrumented system, we can replicate jamming in a way that I couldn't even do live. I mean, we were able to do live jamming here, but I can put emitters on the battlefield that are solely virtual, but that the brigade would get that feed that's been collected against. Mm. And so, you know, continuing to expand the virtual live merger to create an environment that's more challenging, that's at a bigger scale as well. I mean, those are some of the directions that we're going. And with all that, at the end of the day, it's remaining true to the fundamentals that we know matter in warfighting. Some of the directions that we're going forward. But we are looking at, you know, my predecessor, Colonel Sazlov, you know, the one device. And so we've taken our iPads and we're trying to merge everything down. So, you know, frankly, the Green Book becomes a thing of the past. And I've got an iPad that has all the apps necessary to include the IS, to include voice, that it makes it easier to do a hot wash where I can sit down and I can show you the IS and I can play it and feed all the way down to, you know, squad leader OCT. And that's the direction we're going. So it's not just the rotation, it's also the tools that we're providing to the OCT to get after how we teach and how folks learn.
So one of my projects that I advised at Naval Postgraduate School was does a data-driven AAR lead to better outcomes for learning? So what we had people do is we had them do a little battle, and it wasn't war at all. It was like capture the flag. So it's contested environment, but really simple. So we could measure a lot of stuff because warfare is hard to measure, obviously. And then we said, how'd you do? And then we showed them the data about how they did. And then we said, you know, now how do you think you did? And do you, correction. We asked them how they did. We said, what's your plan for the next battle? You're fighting the same battle, exact same thing over again. Then we showed them the data. Then we asked them if they wanted to change their plan based on the data. And then we let them fight the next battle. There's lots more research to be done there. But the interesting thing was, and these are all active duty majors, right? Yeah. They're transitioning to our acquisition corps, the students that were in this study. They thought they did well. But of the ones that thought they did well, half of them were still wanting to change their plan. So I don't know what that phenomenon is exactly. But there's, my guess is that they still want to perturbate the system so that they're still getting information out of this contested environment. So one of the, back to old war story, when I was a PL here, I asked my OC, how many times did my platoon initiate contact and how many times did Op4 initiate contact on my platoon? Because miles gear, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah.
If we initiated contact, I'm calling that a win for me. And if Red 4 is initiating it, you know, they got the jump.
I mean, we know the observe, orient, decide, act.
Right.
Who sees who first is most likely to win.
Right. And you know, we got balled up because they had a BRDM. But if we shot at them first, my guys are doing the right thing, and I could say to them, guys, you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, this is 20 years ago, the OC was like, nobody's ever asked for that information before.
No kidding.
Yeah. And so he went to Tango and said, hey, I need all the contact reports for 1st Platoon Bravo. And I got a stack of paper this thick because they couldn't figure out how to query the just the contact reports. So I got every call to Tango about my platoon for 14 days.
The call log, yeah.
Yeah, I got the whole thing. Now, you know, it's great, but like, let's get that into it. Let's get that into a scorecard.
Yeah.
You know, like that. Hey, this isn't the whole thing.
Yeah.
But when I was out at NTC just a couple years ago, the 7 Alpha is making slides left and right, you know, like about every single thing. Like this happened, he makes a slide. This happened, he makes a slide. And then you know this, because as Tarantula 07, you got an hour or 2 hours for an AAR, you're like, stuff is hitting the cutting room floor left and right of all these slides that he's
made. Yeah, it is like doing, producing an AAR here is, in NTC is often a lot like, you know, doing an episode for South Park. Like we're doing it compressed environment.
Right, right. Yeah. And because you're wasting, it's not to say you're wasting time doing an AAR, but you got to pick your battles.
First of all, absolutely.
The unit gets overwhelmed.
Ton of things.
And then, but I said to him, like, you're making all these products. Why don't you get folders set up for all the sub elements? And if 07 says, no, we're not going to use that, you put it in the folder for the most relevant unit.
Yeah.
And then you give it to the lower level OC, and then they can flip through and decide what they give. You know, so you're not getting the whole battle book as a company commander. You're getting a few slides that apply to you. And they like that idea. So like this, again, this tailoring of learning and, you know, what is the role of data is research interest of mine and something I know you guys fight with all the time.
Well, we're gonna have to have you back here to help us look at some of those things.
Love to.
Hey.
Absolutely love to.
Dr. Simmons, Rob Simmons, former Bravo 5 from 2505 and current fellow at the United States Military Academy. Thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate
it. Yeah, man.
No, thanks for what you do.
Thanks for the invite. Thanks for what you guys do. Love it here.
Thank you for joining us on The Crucible, the JRTC experience.
The Joint Readiness Training Center is the premier Crucible training experience. We prepare units to fight and win in the most complex environments against world-class opposing forces. We are America's leadership laboratory. Again, we'd like to thank our guests for participating. This podcast was created and produced by Mr. John Mabes. It was recorded and edited by Chief Thomas Rich and researched by First Lieutenant Anthony Cho. Intro vocals were done by Mr. Robert Chopper. Special thanks to Captain Jermaine Branch and Mr. Jeff England from Public Affairs. Be sure to like and follow us on social media to keep up with the latest warfighting TTPs learned through the crucible that is the Joint Readiness Training Center. Follow us by going to https://linktr.ee/JRTC We'd like to thank our partners at the Center for Army Lessons Learned of the Combined Arms Center, especially the JRTC Call Observations Detachment. Be sure to follow them on social media as well. Follow them at https://www.army.mil/CALL. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review us wherever you listen or watch your podcasts, and be sure to stay tuned for more in the near future. The Crucible, the JRTC Experience, is a product of the Joint Readiness Training Center.